This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Keynes Seminar. My name is Mark Hayes. I'm the Fellow in Economics here at Robinson College and the organiser of the seminars. Let me welcome Professor Jeff Harcourt. At one level, he needs no introduction. He's virtually synonymous with Cambridge post-Keynesian economics. And I don't think anybody has not heard of him. This is a great privilege, really, because, as some of you may know, this is Jeff's last year in Cambridge. At least that's what he's saying at the moment. And I would say never say never. But this is his last planned year in Cambridge. And so I took this opportunity to invite him to come and unburden himself, as it were, to say the things that he had been saving up for the end. Or perhaps turning it round the other way, to give you the opportunity to ask the questions you'd never dared to. So, to begin with, if you're ready...
Yeah, I'm ready, yes.
I'd like to ask you a question about mathematics in economics.
There's an evil grin over there.
Yes. Yeah. Dr. Lawson is in the room. Your recent book, The Structure of Post-Keynesian Economics, demonstrates that Cambridge Keynesians have always made extensive use of mathematics and models. So what is your view on the role of mathematics in economics?
Right, well, thank you very much for asking me that. Just let me say how glad I am to be here. I suppose in one sense I'm having more farewells than Madame Melba, but I'm afraid the die is cast in the sense that Joe and I went in and got a one-way ticket to Australia yesterday, leaving Cambridge on our 55th wedding anniversary on the 30th of July, so... We should be drinking champagne as we fly towards Sydney from Heathrow. The mathematics and economics, and just let me preface that slightly by saying that Joan Robinson, of course, was no stranger to mathematics in her early work, but she'd never been taught it formally. That's why she said she had to think. She did lean very heavily on Kahn, as Keynes did in late years, on Kahn to do the squiggles. And in the 60s or late 50s, they brought Champernowne back here. Again, he was meant to be the servant, as it were, to do the maths for them. So it wasn't that they, at that stage, were against maths. And Nicky said that he was too impatient to learn maths, so he'd just throw out ideas and hope that bright young things who were technically more proficient than he would take them up and if necessary, put them into a formal form. So, increasingly, particularly Joan, I think, they became very sceptical of not the use of maths, but a concentration on the use of maths. And my own view is summed up in a paper I wrote in 1993, which is reprinted in one of my selections of essays, Capitalism, Socialism and Post-Keynesianism, is that maths is a good servant, but a very bad master. And in that paper, I just read it again today to see what I said then and to see will I still agree with it, and I think I do, I just illustrated it with comments from people who were antagonistic or ambivalent about maths, like especially Marshall, of course, and then people who were gung-ho about it, like De Broer as being an extreme example, and Samuelson in the... the preface and the introduction to the foundations of economic analysis. And I ended up with a cautionary tale with a quote from von Neumann about how if you get too far away from what you're originally investigating in your mathematical carry-on, it's just a waste of your time and a distortion of what you should be doing in the subject. But I did look up what Dick Stone said. You know, he had a selection of essays on the use of mathematics in the social sciences, which I think is a very, very thoughtful essay, because, I mean, Dick was both a great economist but also a pioneer of many modern econometric methods and a lot of quite outstanding theory, especially in the company of Alan Brown, but also the work he did on demand theory and of course, the national accounts. And similarly, Koopmans, who originally was a physicist, had views on the strength of using mathematical analysis in economics. But the other two people I quoted was Kaletsky, who trained as an engineer, had no qualms about using mathematics, but he and his protege Joseph Steindl, he warned Steindl, you must not let yourself set problems to fit the mass. You must find the mass to fit the problems. Economics must come first. And I think that's extraordinarily sensible. And I think the people who have been very, very good mathematicians have done just that. I mean, if I think of in our own faculty, apart from Tony himself, who is very keen on maths as far as his tastes are concerned. He loves doing maths. He's a very good mathematician. And some of his early work, I think, had the odd squiggle in it. But we know he has very strong views on this because of his views on closed systems and open systems, principally. But if you take a bloke like Bob Rowthorne, who was a very brilliant mathematician, and so much so that he doesn't have to show off, so that he doesn't suppress the maths, but the economics dominates and the maths is working along underneath to do what he thinks is helpful for it to do in particular aspects of the argument. So I think that illustrates that it's a good servant but a bad master. I don't believe that truth only comes in the guise of a mathematical model, and I think there are far too many modern economists who do believe that. I think that wandering into economics from maths or physics in an uncritical way is very bad for our subject, because there is a big gap between the methodology of physics and the methodology of economics. They're very different disciplines. Though the late Brian Pippard, who's the Cavendish professor, told me that the stereotype of the physicist and the use of maths is really not completely accurate about how physicists use it now, that they're much more sceptical about its use. But I'm inclined to go along with Keynes, who thought that there was, I'm arguing from authority here, Tony, there's a whole spectrum of languages running all the way from intuition and poetry through lawyer-type arguments to formal logic and maths, and that all of them may have a place according to the issues that you're looking at or aspects of the issues that you're looking at. But to depend entirely on maths is, as Marshall pointed out to us, hopeless, because it means you must leave out many important things because they can't be mathematized, they can't be put into a quantitative form. And if you want to see one of the best balanced critiques of the use of maths in economics, and both a criticism of aggressive literary economists on the one hand and of gung-ho mathematical economists on the other, you should read Kenneth Boulding's review of Samuelson's Foundations of Economic Analysis, which caused a lifetime rift between two people who had been previously good friends, but is absolutely spot on, because first of all he shows that he understands in a mathematical way what Samuelson was doing in the Foundations, and establishes his two underlying principles, which Samuelson said underlie all of economic theory, maximizing under or minimizing under constraints, and the correspondence principle, he illustrates those. And then he says, but this is far too limited a way of looking at the nature of what economic theory is. And he says that he knows no mathematical formula for I love you, and yet that may be a very important part of human behavior. And he was a very happily married man, so he ought to know. And he also says it's no good going to Shakespeare and writing let H equal Hamlet and M equal Macbeth, and then see if you can put them in a simultaneous equation, because that just makes sterile what of the meaning that that Shakespeare is doing. So to sum up, I think that the Cambridge economists did squiggle quite a lot, and if you look at my own work, I squiggled right up until an article in 1968 that was the highlight of my squiggling, and I'm glad to say that the principal proposition of that article I boiled down in the end to three concave lines and a 45 degree line. We've got the essence of what I was trying to say. It was about the choice of technique under different investment decision rules, and since then I've been increasingly writing in English, Australian style or Oz style, because I think that it's very important to get the conceptual and intuitive reasoning right before you go into the formal analysis. And I don't think it's just because I was such a lousy mathematician, though that did hold me back on some of the things I would like to have done. I mean, for example, my favourite theoretical paper is a paper on a two-sector model of employment and the distribution of income, which I published in 1965 and actually got me my lectureship in Cambridge when I was here on leave in 63-64. But I was I could never extend it how I wanted to extend it because I didn't have the mathematics. I did show extraordinary good taste in the two research assistants I asked. One was called Joe Stiglitz, the other was called Jim Merlies. Jim Merlies said no straight away. He must have been warned about what a dangerous chap I was. Stiglitz was a young graduate student here at the time. He had the room next to me, and I quickly befriended him, as is my wont, and he lasted a week, which for him would have meant the opportunity cost was three Stiglitz papers, I would have thought, at that time. And then he must have been warned, and he pulled out too. So I hope that's...
thank you. Let me ask if there's any comments or questions on...
In a sense, it's difficult to disagree with what you said.
Because it's so fluffy.
You've got too much in front of everything. Too much of anything is too much. Too much maths, too much. And to say something shouldn't be a master, most conflicts, even accepting sexism over the term, we agree. But I guess my question is...
Would you rather I had a mistress?
My question is, when is too much too much? I mean, what limits do you use in maths? I mean, you mentioned physics, but in superstring theory, it's only mathematical. In quantum mechanics, it's only mathematical. And no one criticises the use of maths there, even though it's all maths, and say it's too much.
Well, I think Pippard did.
What?
I think Brian Pippard did.
Okay. Mm. Well, in superstring theory, as far as I know, it's only a mathematical theory. The interpretations correct on things. In 11 dimensions or whatever it is. Anyway, what limits
the use of maths in
economics is
the question. Well, I think it's in Keynes's answer that there are some issues or aspects of issues in which maths might be suitable. And for example, I have two illustrations in this essay I wrote on mathematics and economics, and one is the debate between Ian Steadman and Morishima and others in the 70s over how joint production destroyed Marx's fundamental insight that you only get positive profits in the sphere of distribution and exchange if you have positive surplus value and surplus labour in the sphere of production, which I think is Marx's one of Marx's great insights about where do profits come from and what determines their size. And once you understand Marx's conjecture, it seems extraordinary to say that, you know, a technical thing like joint production, even though it was applied to capital as one way of dealing with capital goods in theory, would overturn Marx's conjecture and insight. And so you say, well, did Steedman specify the formal way in which he went about seeing whether Marx's conjecture was right? And as soon as you put it like that, it becomes clear that he specified in a formal terms in such a way as not to capture the essence of Marx's insight. And if he'd only gone, as Morishima showed, to a linear programming or an inequalities model, you could establish in a rigorous sense that the necessary and sufficient condition for having positive profits in the sphere of distribution and exchange is having positive surplus value and surplus labour in the sphere of production. And when you think about it, that's obvious, because what is Marx saying? He's saying because of the class construction of society, the capitalist class as a class can make the working class work longer than they need to with the existing means of production to produce their wage goods. Therefore, the total amount of labour that they're doing must be greater than the amount of labour they would have to use if they only wanted to produce the wage goods. Therefore, there must be surplus labour and surplus value in the sphere of production. And then it's a matter of showing how that is reflected in the sphere of distribution and exchange as positive profits in the prices of production. So that was one example I used. I've forgotten what the other example was I used. But anyway, that'll do to illustrate it.
Well,
so
that actually brings me on to another topic, which I think is also quite pressing, which is, what do you think should be the relationship between post-Keynesian economics and other shades of heterodox economics? And in particular, what is your view on pluralism as a goal for the structure of the economics profession, and do you think it can be achieved?
No, but I'm in favour of it. No, I mean, what I would say is that as liberal educators, we have a duty and a responsibility to introduce our students not only to the approach that we think is correct, but the approach that dominates the... I mean, they have to know about mainstream economics, whether we like it or not, and we can teach it in a critical way, but we still have to teach it. But then also, I think, you know, clustering around, you know, roughly what post-Keynesian economics, which is a very broad church, actually, is Marxism on one side, and dare I say it, the Austrians on the other, and then there's the institutionalists, and in my view they all have something to contribute, and we must introduce our students to them. And since I'm also a horses for courses person, which I was going to come up to with some of your later questions, I quite believe in being eclectic, that you can, provided you're, there's not a fundamental inconsistency, you can put more than one approach together for particular issues or particular questions. But there's no way, I don't think, despite Skidelsky's noble efforts, that we're going to get a major reform in the immediate future anyway, in the syllabuses and construction of our courses, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. I mean, we'll have heterodox departments, or departments with large heterodox elements in them, but the mainstream, who are ruthless in their hegemony, will try more and more to drive those people out, either by not employing, certainly by not employing their graduates. And so where do their PhDs go? This has been a problem with new school PhDs, for example. Or just like Richard Portas, rubbishing what they do and sneering and saying they're flat earthers, you know, And you hear that on our faculty too. I mean, someone's telling me on the faculty board there's some great anniversary of Keynes coming up. I'm not sure what one it is, and they're saying he must have a great Keynes lecture, and so they suggested that they invite Skidelsky. They said, we don't want a journalist. I mean, that's unbelievable. I mean, one of the great scholars of our trade, who's a wonderful lecturer, as you can see from his agent here, has packed the Lady Mitchell Hall. and that was their reaction. Well, that is so arrogant and intolerant. It's unbelievable. And so closed-minded.
I had no idea they'd actually considered inviting him. Let me ask another question then about post-Keynesian economics. Would you say that the K in PK economics owes more to Kaleski than Keynes?
Well, not originally, but in my own view, because I'm very much influenced by Joan Robinson's approach, increasingly Kaleski has become, I think, a dominant figure, except on money and finance. I think that Keynes had probably one of the most subtle minds in understanding the banking system, the financial system, the stock exchange, the role of money in the workings of the capitalist system of any economist of any time. Whereas I think that Kaleski, though he twigged onto a lot of the ideas that Keynes had, he was more mechanical, partly because he set it out in an engineering form in a very simple way. Was Keynes wrote very, very subtle things about it. And I just read a very nice paper the other day. I was refereeing it for the CJE. It was, in fact, I realised, even though we have blind things, it was one of the best PhD students I'd had. You know, I recognised it both from the number of times that the author turned up in the bibliography, but also just from the style and approach. But what he had done, or she done, this unknown author had done, was to go back to a very important paper by Kahn on some notes on liquidity preference, which was in the Manchester School, and which I, along with about six other students, attended eight lectures on it in 1955 or 56. And Richard was the worst lecturer I have ever come across in my life, even worse than John Hicks, and that's saying something. And but because there are only six of us in the front row, even though he couldn't write on the board, he couldn't write. It's unbelievable. The chalk would sort of go like this. But it was a very good set of lectures because he just chatted to us about it on the arguments. A very, very subtle argument of extending Keynes's ideas from just bonds and money to the stock exchange, and has very, very important implications for what's been happening recently. Well, he was drawing out, and Joan wrote a companion piece called The Rate of Interest, which again is an extension of Keynes's analysis of how money and the real factors interplay and the role of the stock exchange. And what Joan very importantly said, talked about placements, because if I have one criticism to make of Robert Skidelsky's lecture, which I pointed out to him, is that he does not always distinguish clearly between investment in the economist's Keynes sense of spending on real capital goods and placements, that is, buying financial assets or replacing financial assets that you already hold. And yet that's a vitally important distinction, and it's summed up in the end, I think, by Keynes in 1937 about, he says, and this is the most important conclusion in this branch of economics, the investment market can never get choked from a shortage of saving, but it can from a shortage of cash, by which he meant finance. And so the underlying causal relationship running through Keynes's view of how the economy works is finance leads to investment, or makes possible investment given long-term expectations, which then creates saving. And that is a terribly important insight, which has been so badly lost sight of in modern economics. So the very influential paper by Feldstein and Kiyoko, or Japanese name, I've forgotten who it is, in 1980 on international capital movements.
Oh, and, Horioka,
yeah. Yes. And Paul Dalziel and I wrote a critique of that, and we showed it to James Mead, and I think it must have been James Mead's last ever publication. It was a paragraph that he allowed in a letter he wrote to us about it, which he allowed us to include in our note. And in that one paragraph, he summed up succinctly and right to the point what we spent 16 pages establishing. Mm-hmm. The point was that you get such a distorted view of the world and the policy you should follow if you haven't got that particular causal link. You know, so James also said much the same thing in his essay in Milo Keynes's collection. That Keynes changed us from looking at the world as an investment, as a saving dog which wagged an investment tail, to an investment dog which wagged a saving tail, but he didn't bring out explicitly the role of finance.
Though it's interesting, actually, what you say there about Skidelsky's position. In a sense, it's truer to Keynes, because there isn't that distinction between placements and assets in the general theory either.
And yet but it was in his thinking, wasn't it? Because he did stress what investment was, but then he kept calling them investments.
On the causation,
absolutely. Yeah.
Now, I mean, in some ways, that leads me on to my next question.
What was the original question?
The question was, does the K in PK
is
it more to Kaleski?
Yeah, well, in my view, as everybody knows, is that the way forward is in cyclical viewing of capitalism as a system which exhibits cyclical growth. So I don't believe in the distinction between the trend and the cycle, and I don't believe in having short period and long period points of analysis. What I believe is that you have to always say the action is in the here and now, but there are long term factors affecting some of the decisions and short term factors affecting the others, but they have to be joined up. And the people who pioneered this in the most profound way, I think, Richard Goodwin. And then late Kaletsky. Kaletsky didn't start off that way, but he ended up that way. And of course, they did it quite independent of one another. But of course, I think that in doing that, they were both influenced by Marx, because I think Marx had an intuition for that, even if he didn't. He didn't spell it out like that. And so did Joan, but she never really carried it to fulfilment, I don't think. Partly because she wasn't technically able to, partly because she got interested in lots of other things. But there's no doubt about it that her great works, you know, The Accumulation of Capital and then Essays in the Theory of Economic Growth, are very, very, very Kaletskian, as she acknowledges. She wasn't pinching the ideas. She was saying that the Kaletsky's approach to understanding capitalism was so much more sensible than Marshall and Keynes, because it came out of Marx.
Right, which leads me directly onto the next question, which is, would you support Michael Ambrosi's thesis that there lies a fault line, really, between Keynes and the Cambridge Keynesians?
Well, I was going to ask you to elaborate slightly on what that fault line was. I know I reviewed his book very favourably, but it doesn't mean I remember anything about it. He thought they'd got the wrong end of the stick, did he?
Yes, I mean broadly speaking, I mean, the mythology is, or the tradition, I suppose, depending how you look at it, is that Joan Robinson and Nicholas Kaldor in particular, but obviously
Kahn,
aided and abetted by Richard Kahn, were Keynes's disciples who, you know, took the gospel forward. But Ambrosi argues that actually the disciples were wedded to essentially a Pigovian methodology and hadn't really understood Keynes's point, which actually you was touched on, about the nature of short period equilibrium.
Oh, I see, okay.
And that the, in a way, the sad thing is, according to Ambrosi, that Robinson and Caldor later in life came to reject the concept of long period equilibrium and the rest of it, but not for a long time. And
well, actually Joan agreed with Keynes in that in 1940 there's an exchange of letters between them, because Keynes said, I think I'd be prepared to argue in the context of what I'm doing there is no such thing as long period equilibrium or a long period equilibrium state, and which I think is right actually. Because it is true that partly spurred on by Harrod and partly by post-war problems and the coming over the horizon the problem of developing countries as well as post-war reconstruction, they said that their next great task was to generalize the general theory to the long period. But as Kahn points out very clearly in his 1959 paper in OEP on Exercise and Economic Growth, the Golden Age stuff that they did was really preliminary flexing of intellectual muscles to get definitions precise in the only situation in economic theory where you could get them precise, so that you've got a grip on how things like profits and income and saving and investment and changes in them, the growth of them, were all related to one another. But that was meant to take you back to an analysing processes in historical time. And then I think Joan made quite clear that that plunged you back into a short to medium term period analysis, the here and now, because she said the long period equilibrium in a critique of Harry Johnson, the general theory after 25 years, the long period equilibrium is not an independent entity. That's Kaletsky's view of it there in 68. As she said, it's a mythical situation in which there's no contradictions in the here and now, with the understanding that this could never be established. It was just a theoretical concept, which was consistent and logical, but not applicable. And there's a very good paper by Dennis Robertson in one of his collections of essays in 56, where he distinguishes between the never-never land of theory, which is the end of the Marshallian long period, when it's been allowed to work itself out completely, and the long period in a sort of, secular sense, which is more historical. That brings me back to my favourite hobby horse, that we should always distinguish between period, which is a theoretical concept, because we as economists are in charge of what's allowed to vary and what isn't, and run, which is historical, and whatever's changing is changing according to the particular situation. Mm-hmm. And though Marshall and Keynes weren't consistent, I think you can see, if you read their work, they did really think that.
Yes, I would agree with that. Mm. So on balance, would you support Michael Ambrosi's thesis? Or?
Well, yes and no, typical economist, on the one hand, on the other. But they went down a wrong line, but then they backtracked.
But they backtracked.
And they came back, and in the end, I think, if you read Economic Heresies, some old-fashioned questions in economic theory, and some of the later things that Joan wrote, The Unimportance of Reswitching, and so on, and then Spring Cleaning, when she wanted to sort of chuck everything out. Mm. And her last important statement on this is with Amit Bhaduri in the Cambridge Journal of Economics in 1980, which is putting Schraffer, Marx and Kaletsky together. And they have different roles. I mean, Schraffer is a thought experiment, mind clearer, and the others as process analysis in historical time. Mm-hmm.
So do you think these... you've just mentioned Marx and Schraffer as being essentially part of the post-Keynesian
part of my post-Keynesian.
that was really my question. There were two fields that it interested me to know whether you do regard them as part of post-Keynesian economics, and one is the surplus or neo-Ricardian approach, and secondly the theory of the monetary circuit, which we hear from
What's his name? Graziani and his chums. And then the French people.
And the French, I was thinking more of Claude and his others.
The Entente Cordiale. Mm. As you probably know, I have a historical view of the development of post-Keynesian economics, which is expressed in one of my surveys of it with Omar Hamouda, where we have three different groups there. Mm. And those Schraffer and Keynes, they were intimate friends and very fond of one another, were... I think that Schraffer was much more sceptical of Keynes than Keynes was of... I mean, Keynes was sympathetic to Pierrot, but a bit puzzled by what he was doing. But since Schraffer came out of classical political economy and Marx, while he would have thought that solving the realisation problem, or explaining the realisation problem, was a small part of political economy, in the light of what he was trying to do, it was pretty small beer, whereas to Keynes it was the be-all and end-all of his existence, really, in the 30s. Keynes could never make head nor tail of Marx, so he said, and he was very, very antagonistic to him. Though in his lectures, of course, when the general theory was being written, he did have the circuits of capital in, but he pinched that from a textbook on Marx and not from Marx itself. Yes, but he got a bit bogged down with, first of all, he reacted favourably to Russia, that he reacted unfavourably, and also he was an old fashioned, the last of the English liberals, as Skidelsky called him. So naturally he wasn't sympathetic to much of the political ideological aspects of Marx. But as Claudio Sedoni has shown in his wonderful book on Keynes and Marx, that when they examine the same issues in capitalism, and leaving aside adjectives, they came up with much the same answers, because they both were great theorists of the workings of capitalism. So regardless of Keynes's sneering away at Marx, I do think that Smith and Ricardo and Malthus and Marx are a very important part of the foundation, the base of post-Keynesian economics. Marshall, as Krishna Bharadwaj pointed out, emasculated what the classicals were to fit it into his neoclassical views. But of course, where Marshall is still relevant is in his understanding that capitalism is really an organic evolutionary process, not much more sensibly analysed by biological analogies than the old classical physics. Even though he was a dab hand at doing that himself, but that ran him into his basic contradiction of his life. And that, of course, that was passed on to Keynes, because Keynes always thought in Marshallian concepts and terms when he was doing economic analysis, whereas much easier to come at it as Kolesky did out of Marx via Turgenev and Baranovsky, and that is seen most clearly, I think, in his review of the general theory.
But given that, I mean, if we take one of those schools, I mean, the surplus approach, Murray Milgate and John Eatwell.
Let's go back to Pierrot Schraffer.
Coming out of Schraffer.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at the core of that is the idea of long period equilibrium, which we were just discussing was ultimately rejected by...
But I don't think Schraffer would have had a bar with the concept of equilibrium, at least in the neoclassical sense.
I think John Eatwell wrote a famous article called "The Long Period Theory of Employment." Regarding that it was the long period forces that mattered.
Their argument is that everything that's happening in the short term is pretty peripheral.
Quite.
And you can't make it a a subject of study in its own right.
So isn't that standing Keynes on his head?
Well, I think it is, yes. And as I say, I think the one great conundrum about the so-called neo-Ricardians, which is not Swaffer, by the way, in my view, is that they say you can only theorise about sustained and persistent forces. Well, there is no more sustained and persistent force in economic life than uncertainty. And yet they rule uncertainty and expectations out of their theory. But the concept of the surplus, I mean, which goes straight back to Smith and Marx and Ricardo, is incredibly important in understanding the workings of capitalism and the distinction between the sphere of production and the sphere of distribution and exchange. I mean, even Samuelson in his Ninth Decade came to understand that because, as I've often... May I repeat myself? Of course
I may. May repeat.
Yes, I'm nearly 80, of course I can repeat myself. In a lecture that he gave to the Bank of Italy in the... I think it was in the 80s or the 90s. It was probably in the 90s. He said he was comparing the European economies and the American economy, and he said, no economist, he's never considered modesty a virtue, nobody has noticed the two characteristics of modern American capitalism: ruthless capitalists and cowed and quiescent workforce. And which led me to write in two places, I do repeat myself, Carl, that you should have lived to see this hour. But the point he was making was that the way capitalism works is that national and international capital had decided that they needed a bigger surplus, and therefore they used monetarist policies to create such heavy and sustained levels of unemployment that the bargaining power of the wage earners was destroyed, and that created a much bigger potential surplus, as would be illustrated in production of commodities by means of commodities. But they had forgotten about the basic contradictions that you always find in any mode of production, and in this particular case, by using monetarism, what Tommy Bellow called the incomes policy of Karl Marx, to create large amounts of sustained unemployment in order to increase the potential surplus, they destroyed the ability to realise the surplus because they simultaneously had an adverse effect on the amount of accumulation, the amount of investment that people want. So the surplus went to waste. And if you look at, with the exception of America and the UK, because America was partly pump priming through defence expenditure and partly Vokler got the wind up and told Reagan, for God's sake, expand the economy after 2 years of the first 2 years of Reagan. But if you and then after Mrs. T's excesses, what's his name? Not Dominic Lawson, Nigel Lawson, in his large existence, as opposed to his mild anorexic existence now. That's going on the air, is it? Good. Just send him my cheerio. He expanded the economy. But with the exception of those, if you look at the performance of many capitalist economies, advanced capitalist economies, over from the 70s on, and compare it with what they did during the years of the long boom or the golden age of capitalism, you'll see that the rates of accumulation are very disappointing. And I think that you have to have some knowledge of Marx to understand why that came about. And also, to what Alistair was saying, how you say we're just political ideologues or have been political ideologues in the country. No, I don't think that's fair. I mean, first of all, they thought the reason to be of economics, regardless of how far away it was proper policy. But secondly, they felt you could not separate political factors and sociological factors from economic factors in analysing society. And that's the proper role, I would say, of a political economist in the old-fashioned sense. From Smith, Ricardo, Malthus, Marx on. They all did that. I mean, they all had a political aspect, and they had an economic aspect, a sociological aspect, and a historical aspect. And that's how we should be training our undergraduates now, but of course we're not.
If I could just go back to just press you a bit on the monetary circuit thing.
Behind the first
half of my question was the idea, well, how can a long period theory be compatible with Keynes? Behind the monetary circuit question really lies, how can a theory which actually regards liquidity preference as a mistake, according to Alan Pargues, I think, how can that be called a post-Keynesian theory?
Well, I have to admit that I, apart from Graziani, I know very little about monetary circuit theory, but I have talked a lot to Giuseppe Fontana about it, who worships at the shrine of Malcolm Sawyer on the one hand and Graziani on the other, and he has no trouble in calling himself a post-Keynesian, but I suppose the argument is that you could take the insights from the circuit approach but work out ways in which liquidity preference could be included. For example, Sheila Dow in the second edition of the General Theory has managed to made liquidity preference up to date, as it were, and Jörg Biebo's recent book, which is all about liquidity preference in the current crisis, makes very good sense of what's going on, but still has ideas which are not inconsistent, I imagine, with the circuit's approach, because the circuit's approach is that credit flows round, isn't it? And in Morishima's last book, Capital and Credit, he says he chucked over everything he'd done before and said we must go back to Schumpeter and Keynes. And what did Schumpeter and Keynes tell us? Finance and the banks are the beginning of the process. Tony,
yes, please.
You seem to be discussing what is post-Keynesianism, so can I ask that question more at what do you think it is? But can I load it a bit?
Yes.
If we ask a question, what is physics, what is chemistry, what is biology, there's subject matters. Within it, there are people disagreeing, is it Einstein or whatever, but also what's counted as a good theory changes over time. Shouldn't that be the case in post-Keynesianism, whatever it is? I mean, it does often sound, even in this discussion, it sounds like it is a set of answers, what certain people thought of certain theories of this and the other. Shouldn't it be a subject matter to avoid falling into dogmatism, you know, whatever people thought was right 10 years ago has to be defended forever?
It's an approach. If you read the preface to my Structure of Post-Keynesian Analysis, I say that over a period of 40 years, I've found that these sorts of ideas give me an approach to thinking about how the world works. Well, of course, you have to modify it according to situations changing. As Keynes said, when someone persuades me I'm wrong, I change my mind. I've changed my mind quite a number of times over the place. And unlike Joan Robinson, I don't chop your head off at any moment of time because I think I'm 100% right. So you look at the end of my capital theory survey, I say, like all people, all true believers, I have doubts, always have doubts, except I just wake up in a sweat and think I should go right back to being a mainstream economist, which no doubt is what you would like me to do at times, Tony, but that's not the point. I mean, you keep your mind open, but you do find ways of looking at the world helpful. That's all I would say. I have found the ideas that I've been, because I take a historical view of how theory develops in the social science, I've found these ideas put together help me to understand what I observe is going on.
Okay, so just to clarify, there's no post-Keynesian theory of capitalism or of money or pricing. It's an approach to understanding things.
Yeah, yes, but I mean, it does also have a vision. I mean, I would say that very crudely, there's two ways of looking at the world. One is that the essential decisions are made by the swashbuckling, ruthless capitalist class, and everybody else dances to their tune. And the other is that the dominating figure is the consumer is queen, who's trying to maximise her lifetime expected utility, and everything else, stock exchanges, firms, banks and so on, are just agents or agencies to help bring about this objective of the individual consumer, and the role, you know, the paradigm case for that is Irving Fisher's model of accumulation saving over time. And I just don't see the world. I don't know how Fisher, who's a very clever man and a very good economist, I don't know how he saw the world like that. I can't fit it into my understanding of what I observe, but I can fit the Marx, Keynes, Kolesky classical view into what I observe of capitalism, because it makes sense to me.
Could I ask you, within that overall vision of post-Keynesian economics, then, what do you see as the important gaps? I mean, what are the things that we're not addressing and we should be?
Yes. Well, there's been this huge brawl going on between Neville Norman and the rest of the people I've got in the handbook on post-Keynesianism. He claims that that we've neglected the international, you know, the open economy aspects. But he really meant open economy and prices, the price formation that goes with it. I think there's been a lot of good work done by a lot of post-Keynesians on the international side. But
Tony Thirlwall, of course.
Well, Thirlwall's the one who took a great exception to it. He's bloody furious. but I mean, people like Robert Blecker, for example, and Paul Davidson has spent a lot of time on the international aspects of Keynes's ideas and post-Keynesian ideas. I mean, I have to admit, I have neglected it. I mean, in my first book with Peter Carmel and Bob Wallace, we have a lot on open economy macro, but then I've descended into mainly into, because of the particular issue I've been interested in, I haven't looked much at open economy macro. And as I often say, that one real regret I've major regret in my professional life is that I supported the Australian economists, the bulk of Australian economists in the 70s, in calling for a tariff cut, which was a serious error in my view, but that's another story. So I do think, I think that what Ken Coutts and Neville are trying to do is very important, that is to integrate pricing policies in manufacturing and other industries, the international aspects of them and their relationships both to the balance of trade, but also indirectly to international capital flows. That's very important. Secondly, I think that we, with notable exceptions like Rick Holt, we have neglected the climate change problems and the evolutionary and environmental aspects of what economists should be interested in. Thirdly, again with notable exceptions, there's not enough work done by a lot of post-Keynesians on the problems of developing countries, which after all are the major problems, because that's where the bulk of the world, you know, people in the world live. I mean, Joan Robinson's last book was on aspects of economic development, and though one of her colleagues begged her not to publish it, I think that was a mistake. It's full of very good ideas, though not as tightly put together as her earlier work. After all, she was well into her 70s when she wrote it, and she was not very well as well. So I think those are very important parts. Philip Orestes has set a fine example by saying that we must put institutions to the fore in our analysis and develop a comprehensive theory both of institutions and of the state. But the person who's left us the richest legacy for that is the late John Cornwell, who in his many books and articles, but particularly books on the processes at work in capitalism, has stressed both institutions and the state and the government. And I think that I do hope that people will build on the legacy that John and Wendy have left I mean, Wendy's still going, of course, but John is now dead. Because there is such a profundity of wisdom in John's approach, which people just don't take enough notice of. And the other thing I would say is that I do believe that Godley and Mark LaVar have made a major jump forward in our understanding of the interplay of the financial aspects of the economy with the real aspects of the economy. And again, they've given us a framework that we can use and develop in our understanding. And no more so is that important. But now, because we have to reform and control and financial sectors, and we don't seem to be doing that very well, but we need to understand exactly what's going on, because the mainstream theory can't explain, of course, mainly because they assume away all the issues that are in there. I'm going to give a lecture at SOAS in May called The Crisis in Mainstream Economics, and I want to talk about this, but I will start off by saying, of course, you realise I've pinched this title from Hicks, The Crisis in Keynesian Economics, so I'll turn it on its head, and I'll quote Jim Callaghan saying, crisis, what crisis, which he never said, but just so I can be all things to all people.
Let me turn a little bit towards yourself now.
Good heavens, my favourite subject.
Yeah. I'm not so sure. And ask you what you regard yourself as your most important contribution to economic thought.
To economic thought, that's a good question. In Who's Who in Economics, I said I regard my principal contribution had been to introduce in a fair and good-humoured way the basis of the controversies between the two Cambridges, and I think it was useful to have done that to a generation of graduate students of no one else, and also to be able to distinguish between people on the one hand and their views on the other, so that I could remain respectful and friendly with all people in it, regardless of whether we non-violently disagree with one another or other. The trouble is that, I've dabbled in everything, so I don't know where I've made contributions. I mean, I had some graduate students who thought my paper, Marshall, Schraffer and Keynes, Incompatible Bedfellows, was a path-breaking paper that got them going. But that had some important ideas in it. My own favourite paper is this two-sector model, because I put everything that I'd thought about up until there in it. But as I say, it never took off. And also, I think the work that Peter Kenyon and I did on pricing and the investment decision was important to help understanding the role of oligopolistic industries in modern capitalism, and to try and think through not only their own behaviour, but the systemic effects of them. And that's been one of my lasting interests. I've never solved the problem, but I've been thinking about it since I was an undergraduate, because I was so influenced by Rothschild. Gert Rothschild's famous paper, Price Theory and Oligopoly. Yeah. And I wanted to see how his oligopolists as interested in secure profits as maximum profits, how that affected the systemic behaviour of the Keynes model of capitalism. And I thought that, I still think that's a very important thing to think about, because it's integral to our understanding of how the real world works.
So I know you've been retired for a few years now, but
12.
What are you working on at the moment?
That's a good question. I'm, along with Peter Kreisler, I'm general editor of a two-volume handbook on post-Keynesian economics for Oxford University Press. So I've got about 50 willing slaves slaving away to produce their first drafts at the end of this month, looking straight at two of them, yes. Tony got away. he got Steve Pratton is doing what, one of the papers that I have that Tony might have done as well. So that's a major thing. But I made a proposal to Palgrave Macmillan for a volume of essays called On Skidelsky's Canes and Other Essays. And they were very taken with it, and they said, well, why don't you make it two volumes? So at the moment I'm putting together two volumes of selected essays which I'll write introductions to and show how they fit in together. And one will be called On Skidelsky's Canes and Other Essays. I'm thinking of calling the other one Cambridge Harvest. You know, E.M. Forster, towards the end of his life, had a collection of papers called Harvest. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going back to Australia now. Why don't I gather together everything that's left of what I've done in Cambridge? And so I think the second volume will be called Cambridge Harvest and Selected Essays of G.C. Harcourt. And so they are will be in, there'll be an introduction. There'll be autobiographical essays in each, because I've written a number of those over the years. So always commissioned, by the way. I just didn't sit down and write my autobiography. And indeed, when Edward Elgar said, oh, I do wish you'd write your autobiography. You know so many people. You have such interesting stories to say about them. Yes, I said, so I do, Edward, and I value my friendship. So thanks, but no thanks. Because I think autobiographies have to be honest. And that's a terrible thing to have to be honest both about yourself and also about your friends. unless you're a Bloomsbury type, in which you just revel in it. And then there'll be post-Keynesian theoretical on a variety of topics, some jointly written, some written by me, and then review articles. I do think that reviewing is becoming a lost art, which I think is, we have a great responsibility to take seriously evaluations and assessments of our profession's books. It's very important, I think, and the people who dodge doing that, I think, are not. It's like refusing to take PhD students, or in the case of the Young Turks in the faculty of taking a college fellowship so that you can teach the young. I don't know why they want to be in the university if they don't want to teach the young. I mean, that's our major excuse for living as a university teacher, I think. And then there'll be survey articles, then there'll be policy sections, and then there'll be intellectual biographies and tributes to more and more friends who've died, and then some general essays. And in the general essays, what have I got? Ah, yes. I'm going to publish the accounts I've had of my four of my papers who were rejected, which come from the Shepherd and originally rejected. They ended up being published somewhere else. But these two young graduate students, Joshua Gans and George Shepherd. George Shepherd is the son of Shepherd's Lemma, but James Burleys is very upset that every Cambridge undergraduate in economics doesn't know about. He cannot lecture unless you know Shepherd's Lemma. Have you met Shepherd's Lemma?
Met it.
Yeah, or used it?
No, I haven't.
No, it washes your flocks by night. Yeah. And
I must.
Yes. Anyway, they wrote to 160 well-known economists and said, have you ever had a paper reject? If so, would you like to tell us the story? And then they wrote a very elitist article in the Journal of Economic Perspectives where they only talked about J.B. Clark medalists and Nobel Prize winners or someone who might have helped their careers telling the story. But then George Shepherd put together all the original letters, and he had a very good foreword by Ken Arrow and a lovely article by Bob Clough, who, you know, is the most idiosyncratic and maverick editor of the AER in the history of the AER, and then the summing up by Shepherd. And I wrote quite a long reply to to Gans and Shepherd about four of my articles, the story of their initial rejections and what happened. So I thought I might publish that as well. And then I gave when I got an honorary degree at Melbourne, my old university, I gave the upwards, inwards, outwards, and talk to the new graduates, where I expressed what I thought about the pluses and minuses of modern life and modern university and what university should be about. And so I thought I would put that in as well. And I also wrote the entry on Cambridge economics for the Cambridge 800 yearbook, and I've dug up the first draft of that. Mm. And I thought that I'd put that in as a general essay as well.
So this will be the Cambridge Harvest.
That'll be the Cambridge Harvest. And in the policy one, it's not only, I've got an article with John Greave-Smith on what was thought to be the best critical evaluation of Gordon Brown's economic policies, which was in Soundings, and an argument for compulsory voting, which is very relevant at the moment, preferably allied with the Australian preference system, and one called Chickens Coming Home to Roost, which was came out of the the firemen's strike. But I used that to generalise into what was being done to public sector workers' pay and conditions, and how disastrous that was. And the interesting thing was that was based on, when I was in Australia, we used to have a thing called Notes on the News, or it was called News on the Notes, actually, but Nose on the Newts or something, in honour of what's his name? He's a great newt lover, Livingstone, Ken Livingstone. Yeah, he keeps newts. Anyway, you'd go on a roster, and twice a month you would have a 3.5 minute slot to talk about a topical problem. And we'd had similar problems in South Australia. So I dug out what I said about that and adjusted it to what Blair was trying to do at one time with the fireman's strike and public service. Mm. Service pay.
Well, that's quite a collection of stuff. I've got one last question, and then I'm going to, in the time that's left, take any final ones from the floor. If post-Keynesian economics is now, as John King put it, an embattled minority,
yes,
without, in most cases, the ability to reproduce itself through new graduate students, what are our chances?
That's a good question. Well, I remember, as you know, I was an anti-Vietnam War protester for 5.5 years in South Australia. And then when the Iraq War was starting, I was asked to address the assembled multitude in front of the Guildhall here. And there were 40 people there. And I said, well, look, we outnumber those who started the Russian Revolution by 10 to 1. So you're embattled, you're a minority, so what? Now that's my perennial optimism, because I'm also on record as saying that just because your cause is right and just doesn't mean you're going to prevail.
Yeah.
John, who's a very realistic chap, is probably right, but we have to keep on battling, and surely there must be some interplay between what's happening in the world, the bankruptcy of mainstream economics, which more and more graduate students are becoming conscious of, on lots of issues that they'd like answers to, and the fact that we do evolve a very considerable, in many ways, excellent literature. I mean, I think the articles in the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics, there are many good articles in there. I think the Cambridge Journal, though it has its ups and downs, has some very important papers and issues discussed in it. Though there were terrible internal brawls in Rope still has some very good symposiums and really interesting articles. And then a lot of the history of thought journals have things to say, and John Davis's, well, it's no longer his, but the Journal of Social Economy.
Yeah,
they all have excellent papers. So there's something to build on.
Yes.
And there are a number of very good books. Your own interpretation of Keynes, Jörg Bibo's latest book, as I mentioned, Godley and Lavoie, Passanetti's last book, I'd be immodest and I say my structure of post-Keynesian economics, and Prue and my biography of Joan Robinson, I think, is a good source to go to, and John King's life of intellectual life of Cowdell in the same series, an absolute tour de force. Mm. So that the literature is there if the students can be directed towards it.
Yes.
And and often it does catch on. I mean, I often tell the story of chairing at in 1980 at McGill in the Eastern Economic Association meeting, where Joan Robinson gave the keynote address. Mm-hmm. And she gave the very near holistic paper Spring Cleaning, you know, chuck the lot out and start again. So she gave this paper and to a huge audience. Of course, they were stunned mullet at the end. So, typical me, I said, well, come on, you've just heard one of the world's most distinguished economists telling you that everything you've ever done is a load of tripe. Surely some of you are going to join in a discussion, but there was no response. But a young woman came up to me afterwards and said that she'd been utterly turned on by Joan's passion and what she had to say. She'd been getting very disillusioned in what she had to teach. I think it was at Wellesley. And so we literally talked all night. And I sent her away with a reading list which went right down her arm. And she did read to herself, and her fires were rekindled. Now, I know enough. I'm not Germaine Greer. I don't generalise from a sample of one, to which Germaine Greer. But nevertheless, there must be bright young people out there who are searching for something which makes more sense to them. And since, as you and I, I'm sure, believe, what we do does make sense, so we shouldn't give up hope. We have to keep on fighting. We have to be optimists all our life. And I'm very tickled by Ed Fulbrook, who said that he was in deep despair, and he heard me give an after-dinner speech at the World Congress of Social Economists, not economists being social, but social economists, yeah. I think at EMMA, and he referred to me as the grizzled old warrior, which I rather insulted. I mean, I was only a mere 71 or something at that age, but he said, but that spurred him on, and that started the very wrongly called autistic.
Yeah,
So I was really, so who knows? I mean, think of John the Baptist, and you know, you don't, you think of the sower, you scatter. Yeah, well, I don't want to have my head chopped off, but you scatter ideas around you. You do have students, you do have PhD students. So keep going. I mean, Joan Robinson, at the end of her last stint of teaching in Williams, took her favourite student from the class aside and said, "Promise me that whatever you'll do, don't be an economist." But I would rather say, "Come on board. There's a battle to be pitched and a world to be won. So right on."
Thank you. That's great. Now we've got 3 minutes left. Alistair has been champing at the bit down here, but is there anybody else who hasn't spoken who would like to ask a question to Jeff? This is your chance. No? Alistair.
I think Jeff's having a laugh. I mean, he gets near to reality when he says the function of economics is to consider what is proper policy, I think he called it.
I think Joan Robinson put it as the purpose of economics was in order not to be deceived by
economists. Looking straight at you.
I just want to stick to Jeff, as he's here to defend us. But I mean, that begs the question, and he seems to be rather unclear himself when he considers consumerist king to be one of the proper functions. Now, it seems to me...
I didn't say that. Well, I said that was the alternative vision, one which I didn't accept.
Well, alternative to something else, which makes my point. But the important thing, I think, is that when we start to consider what is economics for, we sublimate in a discussion of theoretical constructs. And the discussion of these constructs seems to be an end in itself. I find this quite frustrating. And I would like to suggest to you that one thing all Keynesians have in common, post and pre and apre, is they're trying to maximize sustainable employment.
For themselves, you mean? Oh, no, I see what you mean.
But I always like to have a straight line. Just stick with the notion, what are they trying to maximize? Is it sustainable employment? And if so, what is the cost of that? What is the constraint? Are they maximizing without constraint, which is not me very sensible?
Mm-hmm. Well, once Omar Hamouda asked me what I thought economics was for, this is what I said.
Who asked you?
Omar Hamouda. He was chap I collaborated with on for a number of years and who edited my second volume of selected essays. It's an Algerian chap who teaches at Glendon College in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Good guy.
Yes. Yes, he shared a room with you.
He did.
Yes. And osmosis occurred. So what is economics about? It's to make the world a better place for ordinary men and women to produce a more just and equitable society. In order to do that, you have to understand how particular societies work and where the pockets of power are and how you can either alter those or work within them and produce desirable results for ordinary people, not just for the people who have power. I see economics as very much a moral as well as a social science and very much a handmaiden to progressive thought. It's really the study of the processes whereby surpluses are created in economies, how they're extracted, who gets them, and what they do with them. All economies have created surpluses in one way or another. Capitalism does it in a particular way, and that is the process in which I'm most interested, because I live in capitalist economies. At the same time, I would like to help to create a society where the surplus is extracted and used in a way quite different from a capitalist society. So I don't think I could be more explicit than that.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on.